and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and Security podcast, where a pair of industry veterans discuss all matters PKI, including digital certificates, trust models, encryption, and more. I am Tim Callen, Senior Fellow at Sigtigo, and I am joined by Jason Sirocco, CTO of IoT at Sigtigo. How are you doing today, Jay?
Doing awesome, Tim. Thank you for having me again.
So this is our episode 29, and we are very fortunate to be joined once again by Alan Grau, VP of IoT and Embedded Solutions at Sigtigo. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm doing really well, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
So yeah, we first introduced you to our listeners on episode 17, which was a very well-received episode. If you haven't listened to that, please go back. And Alan has a very clear perspective on the world of embedded systems, and it's very interesting and worth a listen. But we're moving on to other topics. So what are we here to talk about today, Jay?
What we're finding, and this is kind of an interesting topic. I know we covered this in previous podcasts at a very high level. I think we're going to go a little deeper today because we have Alan with us. We're seeing some exploits in the world where it has to do with the way in which firmware is being protected or not protected on devices. So in other words, we've heard of device identity security. There's also device integrity. And part of that integrity is the software that's actually running on the device itself and the ways in which that can be tampered with. It should be a surprise to people just how little security there is to protect the integrity of IoT devices. I think Alan will get into that a little bit deeper. But I think that today, what we're going to have Alan talk about, since we have him, is a very recent case that I think we've touched on this podcast. It has to do with the Cisco vulnerability. And it's sort of a really good example of a very large, very well-resourced company filled with very smart people who, to their credit, have actually implemented some device integrity controls, but the way that they implemented it was problematic. And I think I'll leave it there and maybe leave it to Alan to dive deeper onto that topic.
So yeah, Jason, glad to talk about that a little bit. And you know, really one of the things I want to say is, you know, we're not here to pick on Cisco. Cisco's an interesting case study for a couple of reasons. They actually make a significant effort to implement a strong secure boot capability. They've got a lot of resources and they've been in the news. So people found this vulnerability, some researchers found this vulnerability, and it, you know, it's been in the headlines. It provides a really nice case study. But the reality is that there's a lot of devices out there that are equally, if not much more, vulnerable than Cisco. So Cisco's a great case study, but there are certainly other things to talk about or other devices that need to address this. But what happened in the Cisco case, it's interesting, is, well, if we take a step back and talk about what does secure boot mean, well, part of that is what Jason alluded to at the beginning is the integrity of the device, the integrity of the firmware on the device. How do you know that your IoT device sitting out in the field is running your code? That's the problem Secure Boot is designed to solve. So when you think about solving that, well, you want to put some code on your device that can validate the rest of the code before it runs, which in theory sounds great. It's simple. It's easy. But when you look at that, it's like, well, how do you know that that piece that's doing the validating is valid, right? You've got to have some, what some people call a root of trust. Some people call a trust anchor. Cisco's terminology is a trust anchor. And the way they've implemented that is they actually have a separate hardware chip on their devices. And they actually introduced their hardware, their trust anchor in 2013. So all their enterprise devices that were designed since 2013 include this hardware secure element called the trust anchor that provides a separate, physically separate on the board chip that you can utilize to provide that root of trust, to provide that first piece of code to validate everything else.
Which at first glance seems like it would be the right way to do it, right?
Absolutely. And the problem isn't that that's the wrong way to do it. That is in fact the right way to do it. And if you can build in a separate hardware security module of some kind, Apple calls theirs a secure enclave, right? It's a separate hardware security module that can store key material, can store signatures or other artifacts used in implementing secure boot and other security sensitive operations. So absolutely the right way to start. What happened with the Cisco case is when their secure boot operates invalid firmware, if it detects a problem, it then enters an error processing mode. That's what a secure boot should do, right? We found an error, now what do you do? They actually then pause for 100 seconds. So if we stopped on the podcast for 100 seconds, everybody would be gone, right? Nobody's going to sit here and wait for 100 seconds. Right. And that's a podcast. In the computing world, 100 seconds is a long time. Now, presumably, it pauses to allow some sort of recovery mode to be entered. But then at the end of that 100 seconds, it actually issues a hardware, hits a hardware reset pin to power the device. But that 100 seconds of time and that hardware reset pin kind of together created the opportunity for this vulnerability. So researchers discovered this, were able to figure out how that was getting triggered, and then bypassed it. So what happens if this attack is exploited is the device boots up, the boot process goes through the validation stage, says, hey, I've got some invalid firmware on my device, I'm going to reset, and then goes executes the reset code, or goes into the portion of code where reset should be. That's been disabled, so it doesn't reset. It just continues to boot like normal. And now you've got the ability to completely control the device. You can put your own code on the device and turn that thing into whatever you want it to do. You could start sniffing data and exfiltrating data back to your data center for analysis. You could start dropping connections. You really have complete control of that device.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. So when the journalism for this attack came out, it seemed to come out in a few different iterations. There was some of the first talk about it was a little bit different than a week later. Can you explain what changed?
There were a couple of things that, you know, that occurred in that. One of them was there actually were two different exploits that were announced on day one, at least in what I was reading. And that was a remote code execution vulnerability in a particular set of a series of Cisco routers. So in the Cisco 1001X series routers, which are enterprise class routers, that there was actually, independent of the secure boot vulnerability, a problem that would allow people to do a remote code takeover, basically from a remote location to get some code running on the device. And that code could then take over the device. So as the dialogue progressed, I think the articulation of those two problems became clearer. The other thing is the remote exploit device, it seems, was limited to a small number of, maybe not a small number, but a small percentage of the Cisco devices, as opposed to the trust anchor flaw that was pervasive across enterprise devices released since 2013. I think the other thing that, I don't know if it clarified or muddied the waters, but Cisco in their response talked about some of the distinctions between the secure boot and the trust anchor, and whether it was a trust anchor flaw or a secure boot flaw, I think caused, even reading through that myself, it seemed like a lot of word games. I mean, the reality was, maybe the trust anchor wasn't the problem, but it was how secure boot was implemented using the trust anchor. But I think as the problem was articulated, there was a lot of discussion around some of those distinctions.
What Alan is, I believe, referring to is something I've seen before as well. Interesting cases where, if you take a look at something like the ARM trust zone, the trust zone itself, I've seen a lot of white hats trying to attempt to hack it with much difficulty. It's actually very well implemented. The thing is, there are implementations, and I've seen it at Black Hat and DEF CON conferences, some of the carriers that try to implement trust zone in their own way actually implemented with some mistakes, and therefore there was some memory that was able to leak out and allow for exfiltration of data from secure places. Another example that I've seen is Keen Labs, quite famously, their remote attack on Tesla. That was successful partially because of an electronic control unit in the vehicle that had a flawed implementation of their secure boot, allowing them to actually manipulate and change firmware on those devices to make that device do what the researcher was trying to accomplish. I think the end result of this, Ellen, that we're figuring out is this concept of isolated hardware is such a great idea, but the challenge, even for well-resourced companies, is to implement it well. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's a critical problem. There's no question about that. I mean, if you look at this, right, Cisco's a huge company. They've got a very, very large R&D team. They've been, they started in 2013 building out a solution. And so now here we are in 2019, and some researchers, after considerable effort and cost, were able to find this issue. So as you were saying, the approach is valid. Like Trust Zone, in theory, in design, it's a great solution. Oftentimes, what happens then is we find implementation mistakes on top of that, oversights, things that weren't considered. And so, how you implement it is really, really important. But if we look at the big picture, Well, I want to say a couple of things. Actually, I want to say, you know, another way to look at the Cisco problem is a little bit like you've got two different components of the secure boot. You've got the secure boot saying, hey, I validated the code and I found a flaw, handed it off to you over here, Mr. Error Handler, and the error handler didn't compromise, so it didn't do that reset. Well, then the next time you boot up, if the secure boot boots up, it detects a problem, which happens to actually be in the error handling, passes that back to the error handler and says, hey, we've got a problem, go handle this. And the error handler, again, is compromised, so it doesn't handle it. So you've got this loop where every time it boots, you know, the secure boot and trust anchor say, hey, is everything okay here? And we say, nope, it's not okay. So we go tell the error handler to handle it. And that's where the flaw was. So that's, you know, just an easy way to articulate the problem. But the larger point is, I actually read something or was in a meeting earlier this week with a company, and they had a statistic, and I don't know where they got it, but according to their statistic, they said that 4% of IoT devices released in the last several years have meaningful security. So what that means is that the Cisco flaw is a flaw in that, you know, they're in the top 4%, and they still have a flaw, even though they've spent a lot of effort and resource on this. And so that there's a couple of lessons from that that I think are really important.
I think what you've just done, I think you've just saved anybody interested in this subject hours of reading. I think you've summarized really not only what the problem was, but also the takeaway from it. And I like your statistic of 4%. It seems low, but goodness, if that's right, it's kind of scary. There's one device out there that I'm thinking of right now that does have secure boot, and it implemented it pretty darn well. I'm thinking of the Apple iPhone and Secure Enclave and that Secure Walled Garden that is so famous from Apple. You're not installing software on an Apple device that doesn't come from Apple or is authorized by Apple through their Play Store unless, of course, you've jailbroken the device. So is there an analogy to be drawn with this, Alan? Like, why is a consumer device like an iPhone better than the 96% of IoT devices that are out there?
Okay, sure. So I think the first analogy is back to the Cisco device. So the iPhone with their walled garden or their secure enclave has taken a very similar approach with this little bit of terminology to the Cisco approach. It's just that researchers happen to find a vulnerability in the implementation on the Cisco approach. So their approaches in theory are very, very similar. And, you know, maybe at some point somebody will find a similar flaw in the iPhone. I'm not sure, though, because that's probably one of the most targeted device for attackers in the world, right? So it's something that's been, you know, it's been through the battles, and so far, you know, I'm not aware of any vulnerabilities of this scale with that device. So that's the first analogy, is comparing it to Cisco. Similar approach, they just happen to either have a better implementation or nobody's found a flaw yet. In terms of the rest of the devices out there, and again, when we say, you know, 4% have meaningful security, I wasn't able to dig into that and understand how they came to that number. But I would say from my experience, my discussion with OEMs building devices, that very few of them take a comprehensive approach to security. Cisco actually did. They had a flaw. They are addressing it. Apple did. They've done it very, very well. There are other devices that, you know, that really have taken a comprehensive approach. A lot of other devices have taken a piecemeal approach where, you know, they'll add a layer of security. Maybe they've got secure boot. Maybe they've got certificates and strong authentication for secure communication, but they haven't really addressed things systematically and comprehensively. And so there's a large number of devices that would fall into that category. And then unfortunately, there's a bigger bucket that are devices with really very little security at all, right? That's why we continue to see things like the Mirai botnet, and there was another one, the Silex botnet that came out a couple of months ago, that was both of which were easily able to take over thousands, hundreds of thousands of devices, maybe even millions in the Mirai botnet attack. Silex, the last I heard, was 10,000 devices that were remotely exploited because they really had very weak credentials. You could log into them remotely using either a default username and password or an easily guessed password, or in some cases, no password at all.
And so wouldn't some of this difference, would you say, Alan, Jason, come down to sort of the heritage and the culture of the company that's developing them? So if you think about Apple, right, it's computer roots all the way back. It's been a leader in its technology space all the way back. It's very, very well resourced and can really approach this. And the iPhone is, you know, fundamental to Apple's ongoing success. If the iPhone dipped in sales, that would be disastrous. And compare that to somebody else who you know, maybe doesn't come from this kind of heritage. Maybe they're for in the appliance space or the consumer manufacturing space, and suddenly they got to be internet enabled, and they're just sort of buying off the shelf components and slamming them in, and maybe not really understanding how all of these things work. Wouldn't that be a big component of this as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen a lot of exploits in, you know, kind of low end consumer devices where, you know, maybe the margins aren't as good, the, you know, or as high. So the manufacturer isn't investing in security. You know, companies that don't have the level of resources that, you know, they looked at it and said, well, this is a hard problem and we don't want to go solve it. So I think that has been part of the problem up to now. But what we're seeing is a reaction, and I know you guys have talked about this some on this podcast before, is we're starting to see mandates and legislation that companies have to start addressing these issues. The state of California has legislation that has passed. There's some legislation in the UK around security for IoT devices, particularly around the electric grid and some components within the electric grid and security required for that, particularly around some solar devices and some other elements of the grid. It's starting to change, both from the approach that companies are taking in terms of what they're recognizing as important, and it's starting to come from the top down, as well as the legislative approach.
Yeah, thanks for that, Alan. In fact, UK legislation has been proposed. We also have US federal legislation that's been proposed as well. And very recently, NIST guidance has been published on IoT security specifically as well. And everybody's diving into that document to take a look at the guidance, because the US federal legislation specifically names NIST as being who is basically going to be the center of what they're going to be basing the legislation on. So it's a very important document. And a lot of these concepts are contained within. That 4% number, Alan, I just pondering that for a moment. That's a very easy number to skew, because it might include things like consumer devices that will perhaps might always be at a price point that cannot have comprehensive security. Even though we would like it there, the price point might be just too low. But I'd love to hear that same number quoted explicitly on enterprise level devices, or perhaps even more scary, devices that are powering critical infrastructure. That would be an interesting statistic. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually would argue a little bit with you on that first piece, in that just because it's a low end consumer device doesn't mean that you can't address security. One of the whole reasons that we're having this conversation is that Icon Labs had been focused on building security for a wide range of embedded and IoT devices. Some high-end, you know, networking devices, but some very low-end, inexpensive devices. And, you know, now as part of Sectigo, we're able to continue on that mission. And really the way you get there is if you're a 100-person company or a 500-person company, and you're building a device, whether it's for an industrial automation environment or for a consumer, you can't take the Cisco approach or the Apple approach and go design this comprehensive security solution, your own silicon, and all of those things. You've got to do something that's much simpler, much easier, and much more cost-effective. And the only way to do that is to find partners. And so there are solutions out there. That's what we're doing, is building solutions, working with silicon partners that build ARM Trust Zone, that builds hardware secure elements, and building them at a price point that you can secure these smaller devices. It may not have the same security as an Apple iPhone or a $10,000 Cisco router or switch, but they still can have meaningful security.
All right. Well, I'll take that, Alan. That I do agree. A lot of this thinking's been done. The pricing can come down to that point for some levels of devices. It's just maybe the will of it has to be there. Maybe Tim's point of the culture of a company has a lot to do with what will be implemented versus not.
And this is where part of the problem is, you know, what are the motivators? So if you look at like enterprise devices, I can completely understand buyers saying, this must meet my security requirements, and if it doesn't, I won't buy. And that can become the economic factor that forces people to take the security seriously. If you're talking about a washing machine or a toy, then it's harder to imagine that buyer, that end consumer, making that the place where they make their stand, right? And in that regard, that's where the legislation comes in, right? Where you start to say, well, okay, if this is a requirement, the same way that it's required that children's clothing is not flammable or it is flame resistant, right? That's a requirement that comes down as a legislative requirement, and it forces the manufacturers to provide the consumers with something that meets our safety and security levels. And it feels like for those low-end kind of devices, especially where there always will be price pressure, that seems to me that's probably how that will go.
That makes a lot of sense, Tim. I'm going to agree with that. So, you know, Alan, while we've got you here, do you have any final thoughts? I think you've really done a good job of describing this particular topic. I know Black Hat's coming up, DEF CON's coming up. We'll probably have a lot more to talk about after that to give color commentary on what will probably be some very technical presentations during that during those conferences, but probably have you back after that point. Just wondering if you have any final thoughts.
Yeah, no, I'd definitely be happy to jump back on and talk some more about some of these things. There's lots of interesting topics out there, and I'm sure you'll find some more at Black Hat. But I think the main lesson in all this is, you know, do it yourself. Talking to my dad last night about a remodel in the kitchen, and he said to me, "Are you doing it all yourself?" And he kind of chuckled because he knows that's not my skill set. You know, I'm not going to try to be my plumber and my electrician. Things aren't going to go well. And, you know, if you're not a security guru, if you're not a security expert who's been doing this, you probably don't want to try to make that your main core job. You've got things to do. And, you know, not only from an ability standpoint, right, there's a lot of smart engineers out there that could go learn how to do this stuff, but it takes time and it takes expertise, and it's just not cost effective. So, you know, find an expert, bring somebody in, and really it should save money in the development cycle anyway, just because of the economies of scale of getting a commercial solution. You know, we live in a world where people don't write their own real-time operating systems anymore. They either go get an open source one or a commercial one. You know, they don't roll their own except in some very, very unusual cases. You know, and security is kind of at the point where real-time operating systems were 15 years ago. And it doesn't make sense to roll your own. You really need to find a partner that's got that expertise.
Alan, as always, you are a great guest. We absolutely will have you back. We love your insights. Jason, of course, always a pleasure to talk to you and to the listeners. Thank you guys so much. More to come on this topic, of course. I am Tim Callan, and this is Root Causes.
See you soon, Tim.